You are listening to 15 Minutes, the show with Osiris Munir, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey, everybody, what's up? We got a little rain. Our prayer for rain was answered. It, you know, wasn't piles and piles, thank goodness, because, you know, from one, it all has to do with balance, but I'm so happy to say we got a little bit of shower and rain today, and that we have been honored by the heavens to bestow us with some rain to quell some of these fires that we've been having. So thank you so much, heavens, for those things that we have in honor of. Today, I have the pleasure. I don't have much to talk about, but I just want everyone to be aware in terms of, you know, just how I bring in the show, that we are under new presidential we're trying things. We don't know what will work, but I don't know. We cannot change. I mean, I don't know anyone that can physically change what the realities are right now, but what we can do is lean our support towards what we think is good and fair. So whatever those things are in your mind, that's what I'm talking about. Lean your support to whatever we think is good and fair, and that things that will bring balance to our country and our world in general. Balance, balance. That means some of one thing, some of the other. Who knows how that might work, but balance is key. So let's get into the show today. Today I have the wonderful pleasure. I mean, this man, from the time his representative said, hey, his manager said to me, hey, I reached out, let me talk to you. I love him. He has been strumming strings and playing the guitar since he was 2 years old. He was recognized. Thank goodness his family was on it and had some consciousness and awareness to know that this was just no ordinary kid that they were raising. They raised a child prodigy that turned out to not only be able to string and bring alive his emotions through R&B, funk, psychedelic, and rock. He's been on projects and collaborations with Pete Rock, John Batiste, Daniel. I believe the guy's name was Daniel. I can't think of his name. I'll let Marcus Machado, who is the person I'm talking about, tell you all about it. Daniel Caesar was who the person's name was, I wanted to say. And we want to bring him on with a loud applause. This boy is bad. He's more than a badass. He's a beyond a badass, which I call a badass. Okay, so that's what he is. Hey, Marcus.
How you doing?
Wow, you've been traveling. I know you've done NAMM. You've been to London. You've been on the news. You've been on Rolling Stone. Yeah. You've been Guitar World Magazine. You're the next best top young gun out there rocking it. So what's it like having a number three on Apple Music? The name of the album, I believe, is called Aquarius Purple, your first solo album, and then off the heels of Blue Diamonds. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about what it meant to you. Number one, how does it feel to be compared to Hendrix?
Oh, it's an honor. You know, that for me, you know, that's a huge honor to be, you know, even mentioned in any caliber of name of him. But, you know, there's only one Jimi Hendrix, you know what I mean? So the only thing that I can do is, you know, just be original, you know, his influence that he has on me, and, you know, keep trying to push things to the next level and kind of keep it pushing to how the way he was taking things. But it's a complete honor to be, you know, mentioned in the likes of him, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Now, it rocked my soul when I saw, number one, I love Australia. Everybody knows me, knows that. But when I saw it was Aquarius Purple, that rocked me, man. Because, you know, that's our color. That's, you know, people of color. That's our color. That's our vibration that
Indeed.
We vibrate to. And so for you to do that and then make it black, psychedelic, and funk, I mean, come on. What brought you to this resounding feeling that you wanted to put all that on vinyl?
Yeah, for me, so like Aquarius Purple, you know, that was a project that took about probably 8 years, because a lot of those songs I recorded when I was in Amsterdam, because I was living in Amsterdam.
How long did you live there?
I lived in Amsterdam. I was in the Netherlands like for like 4 or 5 years.
Okay.
Out there. And, you know, during that time, you know, I was heavy into production and just, you know, finding my sound, working with different artists out there and, you know, being away from New York and just being in the melting pot of like, you know, Dutch people. And then, you know, you go to London and you go to Spain and you have all these different inspirations and stuff. You know, I was heavy into like just recording and getting production. So some of those songs came out. I recorded it, you know, out there. And then finally, when I came back home in like 2014, you know, I was touring with a lot of different artists and, you know, just trying to get the album and stuff together. But every time I would try to finish the album, a tour or something would pop up. So now fast forward to the pandemic. When the pandemic happens now, you know, everything is shut down. You can't, nobody can go nowhere. So I was like, since there's no shows, nothing to do, let me just finish the album. And that's what I did. I ended up finishing the album. And then most importantly, when I got to like the end of like the whole project, I was like, man, what's a, like the feeling that I got from the whole album, it represents, because I think of colors, you know, when I do music, I was like, it's a purple. I get the feeling of purple when I feel like, you know, a lot of the music from the album. And then I'm Aquarius. And then I just put the two together, Aquarius purple. And that's how it came about. And then the vinyl stuff, I was like, man, this music has to be only put out on vinyl, because I feel like, you know, I was brought up as a kid listening to all different vinyls, and I'm a vinyl head. And just the whole experience of listening to a whole album front to back, you know, reading the credits, the liner notes, and, you know, seeing who recorded what, I wanted that feeling to try to bring it back in this time. So I just said, you know what, let's just put it out on vinyl and just see what happens. And, you know, but not knowing, you know, even if people was going to buy it or mention it, because you remember, everything was shut down. So when finally I was like, well, let me just put it out. And when I put it out, like less than 2 minutes, everything sold out.
Everything sold out.
Yeah.
Everything was sold out. Yeah, they've been, I know that is more of a thing in other countries, as far as I understand, is a lot of vinyl. They're bringing it, well, I mean, places like some of the old record stores here in LA, they still do a lot of vinyl, and people still do buy a lot of vinyl, but a lot of people are streaming too. You know, so for it to be offered on all of those platforms, like you're number 3 on Apple Music,
yep.
You know, and you're also sold out on vinyl. I mean, I would have bought vinyl because I still got my record player and everything else.
Right.
You know
right.
what I mean? I still got vinyl myself. You right. know, whatever I couldn't sell back in the day when I was broke. You know right. what I mean? But the thing is that vinyl is very important, in the fact that you can make an album, and I definitely can relate to the feeling of having the liner notes and all the album covers. You know, that was the bomb back in the day. That's where you got artistic vision and everything for, was looking for the album covers. So in line of your being in Amsterdam at a time that you were, that we were all pent in, so to speak, mm-hmm. you were conscious enough to start writing. Were you, did any of the emotion that you were emitting from internally, was it because of any kind of personal relationships, any kind of relationships to self, that's personal as well, relationships to your family or anything, was that enough to stir your emotions so deep? That you would come up with Black Psychedelic and Funk all together in one album and still rock the guitar, still yeah. make us feel the strings, you know, make us feel how it feels to be singing and talking your emotions out loud through yeah. guitar.
No, absolutely. Like Black Psychedelic Funk, Tomorrow Never Knows, you know, that was, you know, dedicated to like my cousins and, you know, a lot of people that passed away during the pandemic. So, you know, it was really, you know, emotional time, you know, everybody was going through a whole bunch of stuff, George Floyd, you know, all the different things that was happening. So a lot of that, you know, I put it into my music. So like Black Psychedelic Funk, Tomorrow Never Knows, Find My Way, all these songs are part of that era in that time that, you know, that we was in. And just trying to give people, you know, peace of mind and just something, just trying to make something timeless, you know, to where that you can put on a record and listen to it front to back. You know, you can have your favorite songs, but definitely, you know, for it to be an album to where you can actually listen to it front to back and just, you know, zone out. And that's pretty much what Aquarius Purple was about. And like I said, I didn't know what was going to happen. You know, nobody didn't know. You know, people were saying 3-4 years, and look how time just fast forward. You know, we're in 2025, and you know, so much stuff has happened, and you know, since that time. So you know, for me, it was just being in that moment and just, you know, just saying, just give it your all, you know what I mean? And let the music speak for itself.
And you being Aquarian, and you know that at least the most of the Aquarians I know, or people that have strong Aquarian emphasis in their natal charts, are usually often ahead of the time. And often being ahead of the time, there's a great deal of suffering that goes along with being ahead, like, you know, because you're ahead, and there are people that can be ahead with you, but very few people can be ahead with you because very few people are that conscious and aware to be ahead with you. And then those that try to be ahead with you, they're looked at as odd and strange as you are because you're ahead of time, all of that. So how were you able to take the environment, and in taking the environment of being in Amsterdam in another country, and how were you received there? And how much did that influence your work from being there as well? Not only being a man of color, a Black American, you know, person of color, but also being influenced by all of those other foreign aspects. How did that?
Yeah. It was a huge influence on me, because when I went, you know, this was the time that Obama had just came into office. So I had missed. I saw him become the president over there, you know what I mean? And, you know, and people having such an open mind on music, you know, wasn't caught up in, you know, what trend that you were doing or what, you know, what type of style you were playing. People was just like, hey, if you can play whatever type of music it is, I'm all ears. And just people having an open mind and definitely being receptive and, you know, working with different artists, you know, people from Portugal, people from Spain, people from Germany, and, you know, just seeing all these different, you know, experiencing all those different things, traveling, it was a huge influence on me and my music too. And, you know, it just let me know that, you know, people just had an open mind, because, you know, back home in New York, I just didn't want to be that guy to where it was like, you know, you're just playing the same club, the local scene, you know, and then you just become the guy that's playing 3 or 4 hours for $75. You know what I mean? It was like, yeah. I need to be somewhere else. I need to travel. And for me, I was always a traveler, and I always, you know, I always get inspired, and you always hear music, you know, you'll go somewhere and you'll hear stuff that you've never heard before in another place that you wouldn't hear here. So all of that was a super influence on my music and where I am at, you know, today, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the East London and Amsterdam, I've been there. They are no joke.
Yeah,
I know. They're no joke over there, and it does. It's hard to come back to America that seems to be about 40 or 45 years behind. I'm telling you the truth.
Yep.
Go out of the country and come back and see. Don't you see what I'm talking about? We are very, very slow over here. Mm-hmm. So again, in order to bring balance, let's support what is good and fair in the coming years and see what happens, you know, because we, you know, there are some changes that need to be made.
Yeah.
There are some foundation things that need to be upset, and then there's some that don't. So we'll see what happens. But Marcus, when you were as a child and being in an environment, were there any people in the family that inspired you to pick up a guitar in the first place? Because every child that's a prodigy seems to resonate to something.
Yeah.
I know some people that were considered to be child prodigies, but they never lived out what was laid out for them. They got distracted by life or whatever that is. But in your case, you didn't get distracted. How much of that can you credit to your family, the people you choose to associate with, your management? And people like that, in terms of influencing you to stick to your guns and really stick to something that I believe is going to thrive more in the future, even more.
Yeah. For me, you know, as a kid, I was just very like focused. And then, you know, from like 9 years old, you know, that was my first show. And I was like, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. So everything, I always had this tunnel vision of like, this is what I want to do. It wasn't like this was something that I need to figure out later on down the line. And then, you know, I just had elders and mentors like Sandra St. Victor from the Family Stand, of Jeff Smith.
God.
You know what I mean? You know, because of Sandra. Sandra's the reason why that I went to Amsterdam, because she lived in Amsterdam. And V. Jeffrey Smith from The Family Stand. If it wasn't for him, I would not know Sandra or nobody. You know what I mean? Or even go to Europe. So those were the influences that they had on me. You know, they took me, they saw what I was doing, and they gave me the tools and helped me to do a lot of stuff. You know, my mom was there 24/7. You know, she was like a, I call her the A&R, you know, her record collection was crazy. So in our house, you know, we listened to everything from, you know, from Miles to Tribe Called Quest to Funkadelic to, you know, Toto, you know, so there was no like only one genre of music. So that's where my influences, you know, I got a lot of stuff coming from. And then to even go back, you know, my cousin was the late great Pumpkin, Earl Bedworth, who was the king of the beats, you know, the first hip hop stuff. So the roots comes all the way back from that. And then, you know, my father, he played a little bit of guitar. So that's where the instruments and stuff was around. And, you know, for me, it was just like, I picked it up one day and they was like, they saw this 2-year-old baby, you know, kid playing the guitar. And that was it. And, you know, them giving me the guidance and like, hey, like, you know what? Okay, if this is what you want to do, we got your full support. And, you know, make sure, you know, the grades are good in school and you can go out on the weekends and play. And, you know, made sure that, you know, I didn't get into the bad crowd. But I was so focused on music and learning, you know, every aspect of the guitar. You know, I would go out and play basketball with my friends, but then at nighttime I would be, you know, doing shows. So developing that as a younger age into where now, where I'm at now, and where I see younger kids coming up, I try to pass those tools and give them the things to, like, help them, you know, whatever it is that they need. Because, you know, you did have the OGs. Some of them were like, hey, you're not going to upstage me. And it wasn't about me upstaging. It was just like, I just wanted to learn. But then you kind of had some OGs. They were just like, no, you ain't going to play on my stage. So I always said, you know, when I get older, you know, I'm not going to always be young forever. So if you see somebody coming up, you help them and you give them the tools that you need. Because all it is about information and passing it on to the next.
Yep. Well, I can say that if you know who the Family Stand is, you know some music. I mean, I remember going through emotional turmoil and listening to Ghetto Heaven. I think that was the first time I'd heard of them. When I heard Ghetto Heaven, I'm like, who is this?
Yeah.
It was the Family Stand. And I mean, they rocked the whole album.
Family Stand.
You know music, you know soul. That is pure nothing but pure R&B funk soul. That's deep.
Absolutely. You know, and they took me when I was 17, my first trip out of the country to Europe, to Amsterdam. My first show was Jazz Cafe in London, and then we did Paradiso. And from that moment, I was just like, man, I have to be out there. And that's how I made the move. And then, you know, Living Color, Corey, Vernon Reed, those are all my uncles. You know, they know me since I was 13. Yeah, 13, 14 years old. Yep. Corey and them. Yeah.
So, I know them. I'm like Corey and them.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. So you've had some really fine mentors and have.
Yep.
Really fine mentors. No wonder you're badass.
Thank you.
Nice to know. Now, when you did you go the route? Did you actually while you guys were there? Did you go the route that Hendrix took? I mean, did you actually play any of the venues that he played? Did you have the opportunity to follow the history of what he did when he was over there, and you how was that? That must have been
it was crazy to be over there and to really see like where he played. You know, I would visit a lot and go to London and just to see, you know, all the places that he played and, you know, where he got his start before he came back to the States. And then, you know, the Monterey Festival, you know, it reminds me of why that happened, because things were so free, people were so open-minded. And, you know, it was inspiring, you know, and especially for him to do this back in 1966, 67, where, you know, he was the only black guy with two white guys, you know, playing, you know, breaking all those barriers down. And it's just Europe, you're just more freer, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Here, you know, here is just a lot of restrictions and, You know, I feel like even in today's world, you know, everybody's all on this, the newest trend and what's happening now. And there's so many incredible musicians and people that's, you know, performing and, you know, playing incredible music. But it's just like, if you know, you know. And, you know, more of those things needs to be on the platform. But this is why I say, again, we have to come together as a community and keep passing it for, especially in these times now, you know. So the creatives, all the stuff that we're doing as creatives, this is the time that the people really need us to spread, you know, the music that what we have, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then on Blue Diamonds, yeah. Why did you call it Blue Diamonds?
So Blue Diamonds, so...
I wore blue because you said Blue Diamonds.
Yeah, I see, I see. So, quick story is, Blue Diamonds was supposed to be the first album, then Aquarius Purple. So what happened was, when I went to Europe, I was recording songs for Aquarius Purple. When I came back, I was recording songs for Blue Diamonds. A guy by the name of Patrick House is a film director. He came to me, he was like, man, I'm a fan of your work. You know, I'm working on this Black exploitation short film that I would love to have your music featured for you to do a score for the actual film. So I said, man, I never did none of this stuff in my life, but I'm always interested to see what happens. So when I looked at the film, I was like, man, I got so many ideas, and I just kept recording songs. And then I was like, man, I have all these songs to go with the film, the score, this should be a soundtrack album. And that's what became Blue Diamonds. The actual name of the film is Blue Diamonds, and there's a film that's actually attached to it. So Blue Diamonds, the album, is like a soundtrack to it, you know what I mean?
And then,
to the film. And then, you know, that time I was like, man, it was like the vibe of like Curtis Mayfield, Barry White, you know, those a lot of, you know, you have like strings in there and all that different stuff. So, you know, we have more featured guests. So that's why it has like that 60s, late 60s, early 70s vibe to it. And yeah, that was the whole concept of Blue Diamonds. And then when it came, so I had that done in the can. And then when the pandemic happened, I had all these other songs. But then I was tossing up in between, like, which album should I put out first? And I went with Aquarius Purple, which way I felt that was a better setup. And then Blue Diamonds came out, yeah, after. Yeah.
Okay. So you're running 2-for-1 right by now.
Yeah, 2-for-1.
You got the best of both worlds, people out there. He's got Blue Diamonds and Aquarius Purple running simultaneously. I wore purple and blue just because.
Yeah, I see. I see. I should have worn my purple and blue.
I got a purple sweater on.
Clean. Look, clean.
I wanted you to know that I fully support where you're coming from. I get it.
I appreciate it.
I'm very empathic. I know exactly where you're headed and where you're coming from. And believe it or not, a lot of the things that were, you know, like, they don't do anymore. It's not as much as more platform for that here in the U.S. So it's going to go back a little bit more back to that because things are going to get in so much turmoil.
We have to go back to the real.
And things like, look now, this is kind of out of control, but it's going to, we'll be forced to do it. It won't be something that.
And I feel like, and I feel like right now too, you know, with all the madness that's going on, that, you know, there is a door that's cracked open. That is a special time. And you're going to hear a lot of, you know, new artists, you know, people that needs to talk about what's really going on out here. You know what I mean?
And before, you know, we got to say this, our sponsor, didn't forget. Our sponsor, we are sponsored by Coldwell Banker's very own Kevin Pike. He is a senior real estate, certified senior real estate and probate specialist. He can be reached at 818-571-1508. Again, Coldwell Banker, Kevin Pike, senior certified real estate and probate specialist at 818-571-1508. He's adorable, a good guy. I wouldn't be talking about him if he wasn't. We stand for truth over here, and I'm telling you with no lie, he is one of the best in the business. So please call, check him out, whatever you need, whether you're getting in something, out of something, planning on doing some, whatever. He can talk to you about whatever the situation is when it comes to real estate. Again, 818-571-1508. 1508 Kevin Pike, Coldwell Banker. And now back to our show, Marcus Machado. Hey, thank you for letting me do that. Now, I know that now out of a lot of those people that you name that you've worked with, Pumpkin is one of your relatives and people like that. Did they ever, did they want to help you write and do things where I know they were supportive, of course, you wouldn't be talking about them, but did they ever want to get in on your project to say, hey, man, let me, you know, I want to do this with you? Or did they let you just take the reign and become who you are right now? Badass.
Yeah. For them, they just let me just did my thing. Pumpkin, you know, he was, you know, I was very young when he passed. He died in 92. So I never had a chance to, like, you know, when I became older to really talk with him. But like Sandra and Jeff, you know, they just kind of let me just do my thing. And any questions or anything that I needed from them or things that I wanted to know, they was right there. You know what I mean? But a lot of the stuff was just me just absorbing everything that was around me and just creating my own sound. And, you know, for me, you know, in this time, you know, guitar in this time is different, you know, in the 90s.
In what way?
The 80s. It's different because I feel like guitar players were more prominent back in the 90s because you had Slash, Stevie Ray Vaughan. You had a lot of guitar players that was just, you know, virtuoso, you know, guitar players that was out there at the forefront because, you know, rock was more, you know. But now, you know, with the age, but I'm a hip hop kid also. But like now as time moves past and where we're at now, guitar, I feel it's there, but it's not where it was, you know, back in the 90s. But, you know, it's still there, but it's underground. It's like, if you know, you know. And I feel like right now, there's so many dope guitar players that's out there that there's more things that's bringing it more up to the forefront. You got Kingfish, you got Taz, you got a lot of different guitar players that's, you know, doing it. I think now a lot of people would think like only Gary Clark Jr. and John Mayer is the only two guitar players that's out, but there's tons of guitar players that's out there killing it. So that's why I feel like now I feel like the door is open and people are listening. You know what I mean?
Listening more
and having their open mind. And for me, finding my sound was, you know, as much as I'm a Hendrix head and love what he did, you know, I didn't want it to be categorized as just that's only that, you know, because there's a million guitar players that can play exact licks like Hendrix. But, you know, if I want to hear that, I'll just go pick up the record and just listen to it.
Listen to Hendrix.
Yeah, you know what I mean? So for me, it was like, what can I do? I was like, what can I do that I love from Jimmy, but then I also too may love stuff from Coltrane or Jaco or D'Angelo. So it's like a gumbo. You take all these different ingredients that you have and you sprinkle it and you create your own. So, you know, if I'm gonna have a guitar solo playing, I wanna have a hip hop beat behind it or a funk bass. And that's where I feel like the more that I kept recording and finding my sound, and this is where we are, you know? So when people listen to my music, you know, even if you're a rockhead, but you may not know too much about jazz, you can get something from it. It's something for everybody, you know.
Wow, that's a lot of flavor. But I mean, what would one expect from an Aquarian? You guys are usually unusual, very different, not your conventional people. But and speaking of guitar, man, they got kids on IG and on.
That's what I'm saying.
I'm sorry, they got 7-year-olds.
7-year-olds killing. I was just there.
NAMM. 30, 40, 50 years already playing. What's going on here?
Yeah.
They had one kid on IG. I think they took him out probably because his parents didn't want him to get into the dark riches and niches of entertainment without the proper guidance or whatever. So maybe he's under guidance and being prepared. But they do. Just like you said, there's a lot of people. But the difference is that there, you know, many are called and few are chosen.
Yes.
Many are called and few are chosen. There are a lot of people, as I said before, were destined child prodigies, had everything it took, had the everything and just got off, went off the wrong track and ended up somewhere in Zolo land, led by their own desires and own, you know, and not being able to connect to people. Maybe they aren't the kind of people that are easy. They can easily open up to people and say emotional, whatever, but for whatever reason, you know, they got led down the dark path, you know. So, and then there are those like you, like Hendrix, you know. Hendrix, yeah, I don't know what he did. I don't know them. I'm just going on what I read and studied and what I hear in music and being my intuition like everything else. Mm-hmm. But I do know that he didn't allow his whatever his demons were to overcome the fact that he loved guitar. Mm-hmm. And he kept it going. He kept, you know, he kept his energy level to do it. It's in some ways, it deepened him by suffering in whatever way that was internally that we don't know what that is. You know, I don't know what he was going through. I just know that when you heard him play, what are you going to say? When I heard you play, so whether you want to be associated with him or not, it's somewhere in your ancestral DNA.
Oh yeah,
that
absolutely.
You have to bring forth that energy, that something about you that people can relate to.
Yeah.
And that is you know, that whatever that spirit he has, he's decided out there in the other somewhere, which is what way I believe, to impress upon you to bring that forth.
Yeah.
And no, I think that's very important. Like I said, you know, it's important for people to know that there are many people that are really good at guitar, like you just said, but not everybody's going to end up doing all of that. They're going to end up doing something else altogether.
Altogether. And for me, you know, music is it's a spiritual thing. You know, it brings people together. And, you know, I remember there was an OG, he told me this, and I always take this line all the time. And he said that you can play all the notes in the world that you want, but when you go through life and when you go through certain things, that's when you're going to tell your story on a guitar. Ooh. And I said, what do you mean by that? So that means, like, you know, when you're younger, you're just like check me out mode and I'm playing the fastest solo and it's killing. But it's not till when you go through life and you go through certain situations, when you're playing a guitar, that's you telling your story. You know, this is like how when Miles Davis could play one note, and that one note, you can tell what he was going through or emotion that you got from it. Same thing with Hendrix, same thing with Stevie Ray Vaughan, same thing with B.B. King and everybody else, that you can tell when they're playing, they're speaking something to you. And wherever they were going through was translating through the guitar. And I always took that. I was like, that's just me telling your story. You know, when you go through something, that's how you're going to tell your story. And yeah, that's
it. And people can hear that story in those strings. When you said that, I thought about Johnny Guitar Watson, who always had a story to tell when he played the guitar.
I love
his song, particularly the song Ain't That a Bitch. Yeah. I love Johnny Guitar Watson. And not a lot of people talk about Johnny Guitar Watson and ZZ Hill and all those kind of people back in those days that we grew up on and that I love. That's why I know music, and that's one of my favorite things. That music is my sanctuary. It's my life. Yeah. So anything in my life that I know really well, it is music. That's my that's my claim to fame. But I want to talk to you more about when you're writing, is there a process or a particular kind of process that you want to share? Do you cut yourself off? I'm a writer. I cut myself off. I can't think. Or are you one of those kind of people that the more, if you engage with people, it stimulates you to write? Or do you pick certain times? What is your particular process?
Yeah, my process, it ranges. It's different. Like some songs may come out on piano, or I may have an idea and it may start with a bass line, or it may start on a different instrument. And then there's other times where it's real late at night, when it's like 3 a.m., 4 a.m., things just comes out and I have to get it out. So I have to close myself off from everybody and just really lock in and do that. But for me, my writing process is like I let stuff just come to me as is. There's no such thing like, oh, well, today I'm going to go to the studio and I'm going to write a song. It's like I can write any song anywhere, but a lot of times I prefer for it to just come. And when it comes, then I have to get it out. So I could be driving, I could be somewhere, and then it's like, I got to pull over, put it on a voice memo, hum the melody. And then when I get back home, you know, so, or maybe I may be at the airport and something just comes out, or having a conversation. So it really varies. It really depends. But yeah, I don't really have a specific formula. I try to just be very organic with how the way things comes out without forcing it. Because I feel like when you force stuff, then things doesn't really come out the way that it should. And then, or sometimes you may have an idea and it's great, but then when you record it, you overproduce it and you're doing it a million takes to try to get this right take. Then it kind of takes the energy of what the song really is about. So I just try to, like, if the feeling, it's like your intuition, if it feels right, leave it alone. Don't dab on it, you know?
Don't mess with it.
Yeah, don't mess with it. Just leave it alone. Just leave it alone.
I know. Yeah. I can see you, right? You know, you're 3 a.m. and here you go, like, oh, you have to rise up. Yeah. Like, calling you, like, oh, I got
it. Yeah, yeah. And then sometimes, too, I may start on the song and I look up and it's like 5 a.m. Like, I had no idea, you know, because I was just such in that zone. So, you know, but for me, it's like, recording and live is 2 different aspects because people always ask, like, what you put. I love them both equally for different reasons. You know, live, there's nothing better of being on stage and interacting with people and feeding off the energy of a crowd. Studio, I feel like you can craft and you can, it's like writing a song or writing a book. It takes time. You got to let things build out. You know, you can tweak here and there. And I love the recording process of, you know, because nothing is better than when it's done and you're listening through the speakers. You're like, wow, that's the best feeling. That's priceless, you know.
That live feeling of live when you go into a room and the boys put the red light on the door and said nobody else can come in but the people involved, and all you hear is pure, raw, somebody putting their blood, spirit, ancestry, DNA into something to give to us to be entertained by.
Yeah.
That's what
it's
you're talking about.
It's a lot of energy. It's a lot of energy
to give out. We're giving it to you. People out there just sitting and receiving. We're out there giving it to you. This man brings it to you live through his guitar, his music, his strings, talks about his life through what he's playing. So on both Blue Diamond, I know Blue Diamond's more of a soundtrack, but on those, and then with Aquarius Purple, are there any particular tracks that you were fond of and how they came out and how organically they played out? And second part of that, is how long when you write, does it take you days or can you let out things? It doesn't matter. It's just organic, whatever way it takes, whatever.
The writing part. Yeah. Sometimes some songs may take longer than others, but it's really organic. You know, like, for example, what's the song? Find My Way was like one take, you know, from Aquarius Purple. Black Psychedelic Funk was actually from another song. There was 2 parts of one song and I took the second line of that song. And I was like, wait a minute, maybe I have something. And that turned into Black Psychedelic Funk. So it varies. It very much varies. And then, you know, working with people, you know, I collaborated with a few people on the project. So that was fun to always, you know, have different ideas to bounce off of each other. But then, you know, a lot of the stuff I recorded myself. So, you know, I did all the music, you know, so like me recording drums, bass, guitar, and all that. So, you know, it varies. It pretty much varies. Yeah.
Now, which project were you involved with? John Batiste and what's his name? James?
Jose James. So Jose James, I did his last album, 1978. And then the album before, No Beginning, No End 2. And, you know, that's my brother. We know each other for a very long time.
Really?
And just riding with him. You know, he's Panamanian like me too. You know, our families are from
Panamanian. You are Panamanian.
Yeah. So yeah, we very much collab a lot. John Batiste, we've done a couple stuff, but that was more on the live touring stuff. You know what I mean? So we have some things in the works. And then, you know, I was recently out on tour with Daniel Caesar last year. You know, that was great. You know, able to play Madison Square Garden and Hollywood Bowl and just kind of being experienced to the arena aspect of touring, you know.
So, how was that for you? I mean, bigger, you know how you start off in the clubs and then when you get big, you go into the venues and then you go into all the big arenas and then you can't keep up with yourself, you know, like, wait a minute, where was I next?
Yeah. The arenas are different, you know what I mean? It's like, it's an adrenaline because when it's a sold out arena and all you hear is, you don't hear no claps. It's like, whoa, wait a minute. It can scare you a little bit, but For me, it's the opposite. You know, it's like the more people, the more I thrive off of it. And it's just a great experience to see all those people and, you know, for them to be in one room and experience the music and, you know, to be able to play and translate that to, you know, to thousands of people is a priceless. It's a beautiful thing.
It's that group feeling, huh?
Yeah, for sure.
That feeling of
for sure. For sure.
That feeling of all those energies.
Yeah,
and stuff
blowing, you know, into you at one time. Yeah, it's wild because I remember when I was younger, I was like, man, I was like, always picture you being in a room playing for yourself or playing for that one person. And then, you know, take that in times you playing for thousands of people or hundreds of people. So I always have that feeling. So anytime you may feel nervous or feel something, always go back to when you was in that room learning how to play and take that out in the world. You know what I mean?
And all you heard was a roar. He said, no
claps. Yeah, there's no claps. There's no claps. All you heard, a roar. There's no claps. And it's nothing but camera phones and it's just lights. And it's just like, wow. I said, this is a different, it's a wholly, totally different beast of like playing, you know what I mean? From clubs to, you know, like arenas. But, you know, that's the, you know, it's a great feeling. And like I said, I'm very blessed and honored to be, to have experienced that and, you know, just continuing to grow. And that's, for me, it's like, as long as I've been playing the guitar for, I always look at it as there's no such thing as I'm a master of a guitar because there's always something new to learn.
Oh.
So I'm always a student, you know what I mean? So it's just, you know, and always just trying to get better. That's the only thing that I can always say. There's always something new to learn. Yeah.
So how do you balance being the center of attention and then being in the background?
For me, it's two different
things.
You
know what I mean when I say right?
Yeah. There's two different things. For me, you know, I'm very a person that's always wants to bring everybody together. So for me, I've always been a team player. So for me, I don't mind being in the back as long as the end result makes sense and makes sure that it's right. So for me, you know, a lot of the stuff that I've played like behind other people, I've always been able to be me. There's never been a certain situation that I had to play, you know, buy the book or play whatever. So every situation that versus if it's my stuff or if it's somebody else's stuff, I'm still being me 100%. And I'm still able to be free and be able to play the way that I want. So for me, you know, that's a beautiful thing. But I don't ever look at it as me being in the background. I think maybe the only difference is when I'm out in the forefront for my stuff, I have to make sure everybody else is cool. So, you know, make sure the band and, you know, there's certain things that you have to lead. You have to be a leader. But other than that, it's always been fine for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when I say in the background, along with what you just said, mm-hmm. is when on a stage at most of the concerts, mm-hmm. when the band, the front of the band, you being the front of the band because you're your band, when mm-hmm. you step aside and you say, oh, you give the boys in the band some, you mm-hmm. know, you give the boys in the band some, like, oh, on bass, blah, blah,
yeah, yeah,
blah,
yeah, yeah.
blah, 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 blah. How does it feel when you do that? You know, like when you break away and you're probably catching a breath, like most like most artists.
Yeah.
No, you know, when you give the boys in the band some, do they feel like you treat them fair and that everybody?
Oh yeah, For us, it's like nothing is one unit. Nothing is serious at all. It's us having a good time, and it's like us having this conversation right now. That's the same conversation, just on instruments. So when you know, the thing is, for me, it's always about listen to what's going on. So if we're vibing out and I hear the bass player and we're going up to that certain level, let him go, let him do his thing, or let the drum do his thing. And you just know it. It's just certain things on stage just kind of comes over you to where it's like, you know what? Let the drummer get a solo, let him do his thing, and we bring it all back. But, it, you know, that's the fun part of us just having on stage. It's never a serious moment. It's just us having fun, bouncing ideas off of each other. You know, it's like having a set list. You may have a set list, but then maybe song number two, we may be going to something else, and it's fine. You know what I mean? Because we're all, it's like a team, you know, we're all in it together. So, yeah.
And I love that. Because I'm telling you, it messes me up when I hear about bands and stuff breaking up, and they were my favorite band. You know, it's like, what's wrong with them?
Yeah, I think that only happens when, you know, like ego gets involved, or, you know, at one point they were cool, but then, you know, now the money is not right and people are entitled to something. So, and for me, it's like, music is music. Always keep it organic. You know, never let that outside stuff get to it. And, you know, so. And
don't let Hollywood stuff up again.
Yeah, exactly. No Hollywood. No Hollywood stuff.
This is all pure, organic, and raw. Right. Well, I hate to let you go, but we're at time. Yeah. But I want you to give us your IG. I want you to tell us where we can reach you. I think your website is the official Marcus Machado.
.com. You can find me there. You can find me on IG, official Marcus Machado. And yeah, just keep your eyes and ears open. Also too, I just finished doing NAMM. NAMM was an incredible week.
How did you like NAMM? Was it your first time in NAMM or
No. This was like maybe my fifth, sixth time. This year was special than others because this was the first time that I talked about my new project. I premiered pretty much two songs. You know, I'm giving you the sneak peek at it. Sneak peek. So pretty much, make a long story short, Sony Headphones approached me about doing a project in Immersive. So for people that know Immersive, that's like the 360, the Atmos, where you have all the speakers around you. So it's like picture listening to music in 3D or like IMAX, you know what I mean? So
you said Sony, right?
Sony.
Wow, that's a good deal, man. That's a good deal.
Yeah, so So I'm doing an immersive album, which I've never done before. And to the fact that you can take your guitar and I can have it behind me, I can have it on the left and the right, and you can hear all these different things. So I premiered two songs on that project, and there's a small documentary. And yeah, that's something that I'm working on now. And, you know, I have a lot of people on it. Corey Glover, Bilal, Sandra St. Victor. Juma Sultan is on it also too.
For
people that don't know, that was Jimi Hendrix percussionist, you know, that played with him at Woodstock. And yeah, I'm very excited about, you know, the new project and the new album. So yeah, keep your eyes and ears open for that.
Wow, I'm telling you, we are bringing it up here. We have Marcus Machado. Listen, the boy is bad. Anyway, if you go on to IG, I know I'm on there, Blue Diamonds, you will see it's gorgeous. I mean, the site itself, the color of the blue, the absolute stunning image they have on there is enough to draw your eyes and your mind, body, and spirit into it. So don't forget about him out there. And again, he can be reached at officialmarcusmachado.com. Don't forget about me, our sponsor. Let me give another shout out to the best real estate specialist, senior real estate and probate specialist, Kevin Pike Cowell Banker, 818-571-1508. And don't forget about me, Osiris, IG, Osiris_Munir, M-U-N-I-R. _ the painter, and my website expressinabstract.net, the blog onkentertainment1.net. Don't forget for our next show, and I'll see you then. And let's thank Marcus Machado. Kisses and hugs to your manager. I love her.
Thank you.
We'll talk again soon. Please come back on our show. And if you got any time I want to go into the studio and you're here, please invite me. I'd love to come.
Please, for sure.
I would love to do that. Okay, talk to you later. Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye, everybody. Kisses and hugs. Don't forget to smile. It works wonders. Bye-bye. Say bye, Marcus.
Bye.
You are listening to 15 Minutes, the show with Osiris Munir, only on LA Talk Radio.